It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Many people say money can't buy happiness, but according to polls, a lot of people also think that having more money would make them more happy. A recent survey from the financial company Empower found that most people think more money would solve most of their problems. Men reported needing more money to be happy than did women. Millennials think they're going to need more money to be happy than other generations. Other research from Princeton, the University of Pennsylvania, and elsewhere found that happiness levels seem to rise as income increases, but that gain in happiness starts to plateau at around $100,000 a year. Around the holiday season, issues of money and happiness come up a lot. Do more expensive gifts or gatherings make us more happy? We're exploring the relationship between money and happiness, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think money can buy happiness, or does having the right amount of money give you the potential to be happy? Does not worrying about money make you happier? And how do you approach the holidays when it comes to how much to spend, say, on gifts for each other, or do you find non-monetary ways to give gifts to each other? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Christine Whelan is a clinical professor of consumer science in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's the author of several books and Finding Your Purpose, a best-selling Audible original lecture series. She's the director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. Christine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
Now, when you look at all the data out there, and you've done a lot of work on this yourself about, you know, the link between money and happiness, how do you start to sort it all out? Are there levels of monetary well-being that make us more happy?
So the idea is that you can't buy happiness, but I try to take that approach that, in fact, you kind of can if you know how to spend your money right. So it's really less about amassing more money and more about spending in keeping with your values, spending in a way that feels purposeful and meaningful to you, spending on experiences more than things. But at the end of the day, yeah, if you're not able to pay your bills, if you don't have a cushion, then that can make you kind of unhappy.
Right. It may seem obvious. I kind of flip it around and think of it in the negative way. Not having enough money, having to worry about meeting the basic needs of day-to-day life, that can make you unhappy.
Financial concerns are a real thing for a lot of Americans. In fact, people say they are kept up at night about their financial concerns. These are ones that if you can alleviate, yeah, then you are happier. But this idea that if I won the lottery, if I won millions, all my problems would be solved, research actually shows that's not true either. You get a momentary kind of burst of happiness, but then there's this thing called hedonic adaptation. We tend to get used to the good things in life. They become normal, and then we need more to stay happy.
Yeah, and as we maybe level up financially, it just seems like a new set of worries. More money, more problems is the phrase. But, can I afford my rent this month? Okay, well, I'm more secure, but I've got this mortgage I've got to pay now or whatever. As we hit new levels of income, we may take on new burdens that make us just as worried.
Exactly. I think for people who are financially sort of stable, we can say, oh, come on, you know, you don't need money to be happy. But that actually is a fairly privileged position, because if you need to meet your basic needs and you benchmark happiness around that, actually more money in our society is a lot of the security that we need to know that we can retire when we want to retire, that we can send our kids to school in new clothes for the year. So with those sort of feeling like a quote-unquote normal American, those things really do cost money, and money can buy that.
And you mentioned earlier, and I want to dig into this, the way we use our resources, the way we use our money in particular. If we use it right, we can find ways to enhance our happiness. How do we start to audit what we're spending money on to figure out, hey, is this the best way to enhance my happiness?
So the classic example is we want to buy experiences more than we want to buy things. You can get bored of a thing. We do get bored of things. But if you're like me, every time you have an experience, the story gets better and better in the retelling. So, you know, experiences tend to bring you more happiness than things. That's one big one. The other one, though, is a little bit counterintuitive. So Certainly having smaller experiences more frequently that bring you happiness can bring a burst of joy to the day. So in this study, the young people in particular said buying a $7 coffee every day was something that would make them happy. But paradoxically, actually not buying that $7 coffee 4 out of the 5 days work days of the week would make that fifth coffee that much more special.
I have so totally experienced this in my life. Not with the coffee, the fancy coffee so much, but you know, I have a sweet tooth. And I've fallen into habits here at work, and I'm out of it now, of like every day I get a cookie or a treat or something. When I do that every day, it's okay. It's a habit. When I do it once a month, it's a treat, and I enjoy it. And I can, it's actually an experience then. That fits right in.
So we adapt, right? Humans adapt to good, to bad. And if our coffee or our treat just becomes the thing we do, we don't get as much pleasure out of it. Ancient cultures have known this forever. Religions have known this forever, right? This is the idea of renunciation, so that when you get the treat, you like it that much more. We can put this to practice in our everyday lives.
Talking to Christine Whelan from UW-Madison's School of Human Ecology, talking about money and happiness, how they do and don't always overlap. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Was there a point in your life where you thought, hey, I have enough money now and I feel better, more secure in my life? When you're spending money on yourself or on others, what kind of things make you the most happy? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's put this into practice, Christine, with a holiday gift buying. Some people are already done. Well done, if you are. Some people are still out there looking for things. How do we start to take these concepts of what we want to do to make ourselves happy and make other people happy instead?
Well, first you need to know what the money language or the gift language that someone speaks. Are they going to like a handmade gift? Are they going to appreciate more the gift of your time rather than something that's monetarily expensive? And then from there, I really like focusing on gifts that I can do with the other person. So it is a gift of my time. And even just setting a date for a coffee with somebody can be a gift because you know that you're going to be able to spend time with them. So not all gifts have to be expensive. If you have children, though, a lot of those gifts need to be wrapped and under a tree, perhaps. If that's the case, then budgeting is really important, because what you don't want to do is go into debt over your holiday buying, because this idea of buying now and paying later, that actually undermines your financial happiness. It's better to pay now and enjoy later when possible.
We had a caller on an unrelated topic earlier this week, actually. Marcus in Milwaukee called in, I remember. And he said one of his favorite childhood gift memories was not the stuff under the tree, but I think it was a family member who every year took him and the other kids on a nature walk and explained, you know, some of the science of nature and the ecology and things like that. That stuck with him well into his adult life. How do we start to craft those experiences for kids or grownups?
So really, it's giving of yourself. It is, and that really, you know, when we think about things that are valuable in our lives, our time, our energy, our emotional resources are incredibly valuable as well, not just money. So giving of yourself and creating those traditions. So those are really wonderful. You could do it by cooking together. You can do it by going on a nature walk together. In fact, you can really even do it by just organizing an event that doesn't have to cost money.
Now, I want to look at attitudes toward money and happiness. I mentioned, at least in this one survey, millennials thinking they would need more money to be happy. As you look across generations, and I know generational lines aren't as hard and fast as we in the media make them out to me to be, but do you see differences from generation to generation in attitudes toward money and happiness?
The differences are really in terms of age, and it turns out that younger people believe that they need more money to be happy than older folks. And this has held true throughout the generations that we have survey data on anyway. So think about the millennials. Well, they do need more money because they're in the stage where they're raising children. Mm-hmm. They're trying to think about paying for college for those children, and the costs of everything are really high. When you think about folks who are maybe empty nesters who are heading toward retirement, Perhaps they feel like they maybe need less because they have fewer expenses. So, yeah, young people, as we look toward our lives, then we say, gosh, we need a lot. But as we get older, then we can say, well, maybe some of those relationships do actually matter more than the shiny objects.
We hear a lot about how the greatest generation, their attitudes toward money were shaped in large part by the Great Depression. I wonder if the millennials who hit the Great Recession in many cases, you know, just as they were entering into the job market, if that may have shaped their perception of the need for financial security.
It certainly could have, and we will see that as we see whether the next generations are ones that in their sort of peak child-raising years also feel like they need more money. But, you know, these are sort of times where inflation is really putting a pinch on a lot of us, and we are feeling that things are costing more because they are costing more. And you know what we really hate as humans is feeling like we're losing something. Mm-hmm. And so with inflation, if you can't afford the things that you used to be able to afford, that puts increased money stress, and you feel like you need more than what you have.
Talking to UW-Madison consumer science professor Christine Whelan about the relationship between money and happiness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do money and happiness work together in your life? Or do the things that make you the most happy tend to cost the least, or maybe even nothing at all? And when you're giving or receiving gifts, what kind of things do you remember over the years? What kind of things make you the happiest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Christine Whelan, clinical professor of consumer science and director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative at UW-Madison. She's with us today to talk about the connections and disconnections between money and happiness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about money and happiness? What are the things, if you spend money on them, is it the experiences that you remember that bring you happiness, maybe even long after those experiences are done? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring out a caller. Oh, hey, it's the caller I mentioned earlier, Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Rob?
Good. What do you want to tell us about? You can expand a little bit on what I talked about earlier.
Certainly. So my Uncle Don, he was an incredible individual. He was the one that used to take us for the nature walks. Mm. But he was also part of the greatest generation. And he used to say, work to live, don't live to work. Separate your wants from your needs. Always cover your needs and occasionally cover your wants. Save the rest and do this for a very long time.
Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, let's take that to something you think a lot about, a purpose. And when Marcus is talking about his uncle saying, work to live, don't live to work, that's getting into our purpose in life, why we do what we do.
So that was one of the interesting things in this study that you cited, was that, in fact, most people said that they would quit their jobs if they did not have to work. And so this idea of work to live is something that I think a lot of Americans are thinking about right now. I like to think about it in terms of what are your core values that you want to bring to everything you do, both paid and unpaid. And so one of the things I do with my students in the Consuming Happiness class that I teach is we do a sort of financial purpose statement where we think about our core values. Then we think about what we're good at and who we want to positively impact. And then with that, we kind of also acknowledge some of the fears and anxieties that might come along the way and then make some financial commitments to spend in keeping with our values. So if you think about the last three things you bought, were they in keeping with your values? And that's often a challenging question for a lot of people.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marcus, at 800-642-1234. I think one exercise you've tried with your students as the follow-up is you have them, what, write their core values on a sticky note and then stick them to their credit card?
Indeed. So if you put your core values on your credit card, stick them on there, then every time you think about making a purchase, you have to challenge yourself. Is this in keeping with my values? Now, the thing is, we can get pretty creative with this, and I can justify just about anything.
I value this donut.
I do. It's important to have energy, isn't it?
Now, if, like, I think about this, like, I don't know, what are my core values? I don't know. How do you start that exercise and figure out, well, what do I value?
So values are the thing that underpin all the choices we make, and yet we don't often talk about them, mm-hmm. right? So values are not things like, I want to be happy, right? Happiness is not a value. Happiness is a byproduct of living your values. Perhaps you value honesty. Perhaps you value industriousness. Perhaps you value spending time with your family. The other thing that's challenging about your values is that they will collide. So let's say one of my core values is spending time with my family. But one of the other things that I like to do is translate academic research and teach. Those things may have to occur at the same time. So how do you choose which value to prioritize? When you're talking about money, you can't fund all of your financial wants and needs and priorities all the time, right? A lot of us can't anyway. And especially if you're in a relationship with someone. What if I value something and you value something else? Whose values get funded? This is why finances often create all sorts of tension in relationships.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in River West. Pat, hi.
Oh, hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm actually on my way to a store to pick up some working materials. But, yeah, I grew up in that – I'm 61 – in that era of that gentleman two commenters ago said work to live, not live to work. But I think I miss a little of the last – the person maybe that's holding this or wrote a book about this, the woman that was just speaking. Yeah, it gets gray or gets confusing, because if you can find something you love to do that makes money or that allows you to get by or be luxurious, a luxurious life, you know, that would be the pinnacle. But something that gets by but you love doing it, help like an organization that helps environment or people, or it's creative, like, you know, an artist, musicians, you know, the starving artist. That's really the working to live, if you want to categorize it that. And I think it's such an antiquated I think that comment could be, gotcha. It's so compartmentalizing, and everyone thinks the same. And it, like the woman that was just speaking said, you might, like, I sift through my construction materials to kick out this the metal nails and metal edge trimming to recycle it.
Pat, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left, but thanks a lot for calling in. It's the dream, I guess, in some ways, to have a job that really aligns with our values. There's a lot of jobs out there that need doing. Can everybody find that job that aligns with their values, do you think, Christine?
I do believe that you can find purpose and meaning in every job. And also, your paid job does not have to be your purpose and calling in life. So the idea of putting food on the table, of paying your bills, supporting your family, that's really purposeful work in and of itself. So certainly we want to be passionate about our job, but we can also be passionate about other things. And when it comes to this idea of having those conversations about money, the most important thing is to talk about it. What do you care about? What do I care about? And really talking about passion, purpose, and values along with money goes a long way.
Thanks a lot for that call. We also heard from James and Stevens Point, who says money has a lot to do with happiness, but happiness is bigger than money. Health is also a really big part of it. Thanks, James, for passing that along. Yeah, being in times of bad health can make happiness difficult, but I know a lot of people who are living through tough times could also find at least moments of happiness. How do we bring health into the equation?
So more money can buy better health care. Mm-hmm. It can buy better access to health services. So money does come into play there. At the same time, all the money in the world isn't going to be useful for you if you're on your deathbed, right? So this is where It depends on where you are in life. When I talk to my college students about how much money they want to make, they're at the beginning of their careers. And I encourage them to work hard. So it's not about necessarily how much money do you have right now. It's about how much work are you willing to do to put in toward your larger goals. Then as life goes on, then maybe your priorities shift a little bit. You want to focus more on your family. I think of it as the first part of your life is saying yes to opportunity. The second part of your life is saying no so that you can say yes to all the things that you've agreed to already. And then it's the so what element of what is all of this for. And at different parts of your life, money is going to play a different role.
All right, now here's a scenario. Somebody takes your advice and starts thinking about their core values and then starts looking at what they're doing and realizes, the life I've built for myself does not align with what I started off thinking I believe. How do we start to adjust and align in that way?
So you have two choices. Either you can change your behavior or you can change your stated values. And oftentimes we actually behave in the way that we really do value. And it's just like that we say we want to value other things, perhaps because they're shoulds that are put on us from other people, not our core values. So before you say, oh, I've got to change everything I do, think about whether you are happy with the life that you are living. And perhaps you are living that way because you value something else other than the story that you're telling publicly.
Christine, we'll leave it there. Always good to talk to you.
Oh, this is fun. Hope to talk to you again.
That's Christine Whelan, clinical professor of consumer science in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's the author of several books on happiness and finding purpose in life. She's the director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. She joined us today for a discussion about the relationship between happiness and money. Well, you can keep sharing your stories on those topics. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. And if there is a gift that you've given or received that was a big hit, that really made people happy, maybe the giver and the receiver, love to hear about that. Share that in the email, ideas@wpr.org. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Several companies say they're on the verge of figuring out how to harness nuclear fusion for commercial energy. Nuclear fusion is the same process that powers the sun, and advocates say if scientists are able to make it happen here on Earth on a large scale, it could be an effectively limitless source of clean energy. Here's John Kerry, U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change, talking at the United Nations Climate Conference earlier this week.
There is potential in fusion to revolutionize our world and to change all of the options that are in front of us and provide the world with abundant and clean energy without the harmful emissions of traditional energy sources.
Although nuclear fusion would be a big deal, there's still a long way to go. The current record for a controlled nuclear fusion reaction on Earth is just 8 minutes. Talk about the possibility of using nuclear fusion as a source of clean energy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the development, the research on fusion power over the years, over the decades? Are you hopeful that it could be a practical source of energy, maybe in our lifetimes? What questions do you have about how it works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kerry Forrest is a professor of physics and director of the Wisconsin Plasma Physics Laboratory at UW-Madison. He's co-founder of Rialta Fusion, a Madison-based startup. Kerry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Can you give us the basics of what fusion is and how it works?
Fusion is is a nuclear process by which light atoms such as hydrogen come together, fuse, and produce heavier atoms like helium, and give off energy through a change in their overall mass, just as Einstein predicted.
Now, we've been working
to do that. I was just going to say, to make that happen, you have to get the the nuclei of those atoms close enough to each other that they that the nuclear forces can take over from the electric forces that keep them apart. And that requires really hot, energetic temperatures such that the reactions take place like they do in the sun. The sun's quite hot, 100 million degrees, and that gives the particles enough average energy that they're able to overcome that electric propulsion and fuse together and give off their nuclear energy.
And that's the challenge, as I understand it, trying to get something like those middle of the sun conditions to happen on Earth in a controlled and sustained way. And this is why it's been something that we've been researching for quite a while, right? Trying to meet those challenges.
Indeed, that's the big challenge. We know how to make those conditions. We can put energy into a gas and heat it up using things like microwaves and so forth. But the difficulty is insulating it from the cold surrounding matter that we have here on Earth. And so that insulation, you can heat something to a very high temperature if you can somehow insulate it. So we have different ways of doing that. One is to use magnetic fields configured in a certain way using electromagnets to build a bottle, a thermos bottle, if you will, using those magnetic fields to keep the hot gas off of the cold walls.
Now, and as I understand it, there are a couple different main methods that people are using. Loosely, there's the laser method and there's the magnetic containment method, or tokamak, I think is how they say it. Can you explain the basics of those two approaches?
Sure. So the laser method, the idea is that we can use for a very, very short period of time the inertia, if you will, of the material itself to hold it in place long enough for the fusion to take place. So lasers are used to heat the gas, turn it into a plasma, and make it dense enough that the fusion essentially ignites, much in the way an H-bomb might ignite, and give off a very small but controlled explosion of energy that consumes up the fuels of hydrogen and gives off the fusion energy. Harnessing that would be a big challenge. The other technique, and perhaps the more likely to be commercialized, although I wouldn't want to put my finger on that scale at this moment, would be to use magnetic fields. We create magnetic fields in, you know, using electromagnets, and we have different geometries. The geometry that's most common is called a tokamak geometry. It was invented in the Soviet Union in the 1960s, and it creates a donut-shaped magnetic field that particles travel around, orbiting around the magnetic field lines, if you will, and the field lines never touch surfaces, so the particles never cool off.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Peter's with us in Stoughton. Peter, hi.
Good afternoon. I think people, well, you just mentioned a date, but I think people should keep in mind that this isn't some newfangled idea. As far back as 1990, I built the cryostat and annulus for a plasma fusion reactor that was a collaboration between MIT and Lawrence Livermore Labs. And it was even interesting back then to okay, this might be the next step. This might be the next step. And here we are all these years later, getting to the next step. And I'm hoping I live to see this become successful.
Peter, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. And Carrie, I think there's a running joke that plasma is always 10 years in the future, no matter your starting point, which is kind of unfair because, as Peter points out, there has been research, there have been developments. We're inching closer and closer. Can you talk about the horizon for sustainable, usable fusion energy potentially.
Absolutely. I often tell the story that in the mid 90s, you know, I was working in mainstream fusion tokamak world, and I had a decision to make, which was what I was going to do with the next 20 years of my life. And there was a device being built in the south of France called ITER, and it was only going to have its first plasma starting in the mid, you know, in 2016 or something like that. And it wasn't even going to demonstrate fusion conditions until the early 2020s. And that was so far away at the time. I basically decided to work more on plasma astrophysics questions rather than working on nuclear fusion research because it just seemed so far in the future. But a lot has changed even in the last decade that can give us some hope. And so in addition to the fact that things have gotten bigger and more expensive to build, which is the main thing slowing things down at this stage, the progress in fusion energy production, as measured by gain, if you will, made rapid progress, sort of faster than the progress made on packing semiconductors onto chips for computers. The progress was enormous, but then it stalled out because the next steps became too expensive to build. And that's part of the problem. So the companies that are starting now are using ways to reduce the size and cost of the reduce the size and complexity of the fusion systems. One way to do that is to use much stronger magnets than were possible even a decade ago. There's a new generation of superconducting magnets that allows us to build magnets at least twice or more stronger fields than was even possible a decade ago. And in Boston, for example, there's a company called CFS that's working on that project. And we're also hoping to use those high field magnets here on a simpler concept called a mirror to make it work.
Kerry Forrest is with us, professor of physics, director of the Wisconsin Plasma Physics Laboratory at UW-Madison, talking about the possibility of nuclear fusion as a clean energy source in the future. Big question, how distant future are we talking about? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Kerry just mentioned private companies getting in the game. Say they're getting closer to creating nuclear fusion energy that could be hooked up to the power grid at some point. Are you hopeful? Do you have questions about how this will work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison physics professor Kerry Forrest about the possibility of nuclear fusion as a clean energy source. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts, your hopes, your worries, your questions about nuclear fusion as a potential source of clean energy? What do you know about how it works? What do you want to know? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now with John in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question on how are you harnessing the energy that's coming out of this fusion? Are you running electrons through a magnetic field, or is it just the old standard heat up water and turn turbines that way?
That's a great question, John. We produce that nuclear fusion energy. How do we turn it into electricity that we can use?
Absolutely, great question. So the energy can be harnessed in several ways, and the most straightforward is just to heat up a liquid. But maybe you're not going to heat up a liquid like water as in a fission reactor. Maybe you would be heating up a liquid metal. Maybe it would be lithium or lead lithium, and that would be coming out at a much higher temperature than you would have, say, with water. And so that heat could be used for different things. It could be used to drive a turbine, very high efficiency turbine, to make electricity. But you might also use it to produce things commercially by using the process heat directly. And there are plenty of places where we can impact our fossil fuel usages by reducing by using the process heat directly. We also have so systems like tokamaks, that would almost certainly be the case that you'd be heating up a blanket of molten metal or salt or something like that. But then there are other open systems where you might harness the outflowing plasma energy and turn it into a current and a DC power source, if you will, and harness it directly. That's much more efficient in principle if you're going to produce electricity. So both are options, and it's a great question.
Yeah, John, thanks a lot for calling in with that question. I want to talk a little more about time horizon. Now, we had Special Envoy John Kerry talk about this at a climate change conference. Now, maybe if we have fusion power and that's the standard in 100 years, great. Talking about it at a time scale that can affect our current concerns about climate change in the next 10 to 12 years. Are we worried about putting a lot of eggs in that basket that may not hatch in time?
Well, I certainly know that the goal is to have major increases in both fission and fusion by 2040 in order to have a big impact on climate change. So that's kind of on the horizon that you're talking about. And that's where most of the commercial entities that are popping up are promising, you know, to have demonstration reactors on the 10-year time frame, and then a commercialization that comes shortly thereafter.
Now, people may think about nuclear energy and think about nuclear fission, the nuclear power we have now, and think about, you know, the waste and the long-running questions about what we do with waste from nuclear power plants. Is that a concern with nuclear fusion? I mean, if we're just making helium, are we all cool with waste?
Yeah, so it's it's a nuclear process. The most of the energy from the easiest to harness fusion reactions come out in the form of neutrons. The neutrons can interact with the material around the plasma that hold the thing together, that make up the vessels and so forth. And those can create new radioactive elements that have some half-life that need to be dealt with when the fusion reactor shuts off. And so there's a huge amount of research right now to find the perfect material to go around a fusion system and to make sure that those radioactive byproducts are very short-lived and don't require the long-lived places, you know, like Yucca Mountain to hold them later on. The volume is also a thing. We don't want very much of that. And so maybe we can recycle those walls and go into a system where the waste is reduced further. So a lot of that has to be fleshed out.
I want to talk about some of the wow stuff now, Kerry. What kind of temperatures are we talking about here to sustain a usable fusion reaction?
Yeah, so 100 million degrees. That's about 10 times the temperature of the core of the sun. And in order to do it here on Earth, we don't have the advantage of size and gravity. So we use magnetic fields to hold those enormous pressures in place rather than gravity by using magnetic fields. And the temperature needs to be higher because, again, we'll have a core that's burning and we'll have a cold edge, which isn't. And in order to get significant amount out, we have to go to even higher temperatures than the sun.
And briefly, as I understand it, we're creating plasma, not the part of our blood, but the state of matter that can occur at these kind of temperatures.
Sure.
And part of the problem, just in our last minute or so, Kerry, is plasma is kind of hard to predict and we don't get to play with it very much. How big a challenge is that?
That's a huge challenge. But one of the things that really helps us there is that the speed with which computers can now keep up and actually calculate, you know, where all the particles are going that make up the plasma, the charged particles and so forth, has increased so much in the last 60 years that we can almost model every particle in the computer, track its orbits, and predict what would happen without having to understand at a more fundamental level. So computation is allowing us to design these systems in the computer before we build them, and that's much cheaper.
Kerry, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kerry Forrest, professor of physics and director of the Wisconsin Plasma Physics Laboratory at UW-Madison. He talked to us to look at some of the latest news on nuclear fusion, a big topic at that big climate conference, the international one you may have been hearing about, looking at the latest research on nuclear fusion and how it could be used as a clean energy source in the maybe not too distant future. A small private high school in Madison is Wisconsin's only recovery school. That means it's focused on helping youth who have dealt with addiction and mental health challenges. Now, new state funding aims to encourage the creation of more recovery high schools around Wisconsin. Margaret Faust visited the school for a look at how it works to help its students.
It's a Tuesday afternoon in November at Horizon High School in Madison, and 17-year-old Cassidy, a senior, is licking a lollipop in science class. The students are learning about the scientific method by asking a question that originated in an old TV commercial. How many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop? Cassidy makes a tally mark for each lick on the back of her worksheet.
I made it!
What was your number?
Okay.
She starts counting her tallies.
Nice.
There you go. I made it.
How many was it?
5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30. 30. Yeah.
She loses count, so her table mate Alex helps her. It took Cassidy 203 licks. Towards the end of class, a school administrator reminds the students.
The other thing, you guys, if you have not taken your UA, your name's on the board. Please do it.
UA stands for urinary analysis, a.k.a. a drug test. They're a standard part of the week at Horizon High School. It's the only school in the state designed specifically for high school students recovering from substance abuse disorders and mental health struggles. There are small staff-to-student ratios, twice-weekly group therapy sessions, and immediate attention to mental health crises. Cassidy smoked weed for the first time in fifth grade. By the time she started high school, she was getting high multiple times a day.
I did want to stop, but at the same time, I didn't.
WPR is not identifying her by her full name in order to protect her privacy. She started at Horizon in September. Before that, she says she was an aggressive and anxious person.
I just didn't think, like, no one cared. And I started coming here. They were telling me, like, they care. And then it's just, like, you're not alone when you go to a school like this.
Horizon is a private, nonprofit school that contracts with other schools in surrounding districts. Most of their funding comes from donations and grants. But school leaders say expenses are rising and donations haven't increased. The state budget that passed this year includes $500,000 to fund new and existing recovery schools in Wisconsin. Advocates say they hope the grants will help launch other recovery schools around the state. Madeline Brown is the school's therapist. She says recovery schools help students in ways that other schools and programs can't.
They see me every day. You know, we've made relationships together, so they know me. So they're going to be more likely to reach out if they're struggling. And that's definitely going to happen when someone's staying sober.
Horizon is a part of the Association of Recovery Schools. It supports communities trying to open schools like Horizon. Roger Oser is its chair. He says substance abuse is costly.
Dropping out of school, becoming court involved, medical costs to society. And, you know, God forbid, obviously, with the opiate-based addictions, it's, you know, higher mortality rates and overdoses.
According to a 2021 survey by the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, 26% of high school students currently drink alcohol. 14% currently use marijuana. More than half the students surveyed were anxious, and a third were depressed. Tracy Gall, the school's director, says she's heard rumblings that other recovery schools could open in Wisconsin. She says it's worth it.
I've had kids come through here crying, screaming, angry, you know, no relationship with parents, flunking all their classes, not going to school, no job. And they get sober, and all of a sudden, things fall into place.
On the day of the visit, Cassidy brought her pet squirrel, Ozzy, to school with her. Ozzy scampers up Cassidy's arm before perching on her shoulder to snack on some nuts and seeds. Cassidy found Ozzy injured in a park near her home and took care of the squirrel because no one else seemed to know it was hurting. She says she feels like her school did the same for her. Margaret Faust, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, find out about the latest efforts to make childbirth safer in Wisconsin and lower the maternal mortality rate here in the state. That'll include a look at the role of midwives in communities around Wisconsin. If that's you, if we're talking about you, love to hear your perspective, your story. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then you can join that conversation. It's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. It's the day we've all been waiting for. The announcement about a key player that sums up the spirit of our time and the trends of the year. No, not Time Magazine's Person of the Year. No, it's the annual color of the year, as determined by the color consulting company Pantone. Who's the new hue? Without further ado, for 2024, it is the color called Peach Fuzz. What? How would I describe the color Peach Fuzz? I took a look. I'm not good at describing colors, as you may know. It's like a mellow, dull, light orange. Underripe peach? I don't know. Pantone gets more poetical about it. Quote, in seeking a hue that echoes our innate yearning for closeness and connection, we chose a color radiant with warmth and modern elegance. A shade that resonates with compassion, offers a tactile embrace, and effortlessly bridges the youthful with the timeless. So there you go. Could be a nice chill background color, I reckon. Congratulations to Peach Fuzz. This is Central Time.